touch with WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport, serving Fairfield, New Haven, and Litchfield counties in Connecticut and Suffolk County in New York, as well as communities around the world, and streaming via podcast and streaming at WPKN.org. Is very important for the continuation and maintenance of a democracy. One should be tolerant of all views different to yours. It is much better to use words to settle differences than with weapons. You see, weapons destroy human beings. When all these differing views are put together, a consensus should be found to move the nation forward together for one common cause. At the end of an argument, we may disagree but not become disagreeable. The show is What's Your Point? Right here on WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM and www.wpkn.org. I am your host, Garnet Anker. Touch with WPKN. The show is What's Your Point? And my quote for this morning says, patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. And Dr. Samuel Johnson, 18th century English poet, essayist, moralist, literary critic, biographer, editor, and lexicographer. And, today on the show, we have a discussion with my guest on radical extremism, racial extremism in the United States since the inauguration of this president. Is it on the rise? And the crisis on the southern border, the Muslim ban upheld by the United States Supreme Court, ignoring international law. Now, on the show today is Mark Potok, a former senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark is currently senior fellow at the Center for Analysis of the Radical Right. He's one of the country's leading experts on world of extremism. Mark is no stranger to What's Your Point, as he has appeared here before. Mark Potter, good morning, and thanks for getting up this early where you are.
Oh, it's not so early. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, good. Good good to know that. From your vantage point, would you say racial extremism is on the rise in the United States since the inauguration of this president, or has it remained the same?
No, it's certainly on the rise. You know, you can see that in real polling and all kinds of scientific work that's been done. And, you know, I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything shocking when I say that this is true in Europe as well, along with quite a lot of other countries. You know, we are seeing the rise of a kind of racial nationalism that I think is in direct response, a kind of backlash against globalization, against, you know, and that is expressed most clearly in attitudes towards immigration. And obviously, as I say, that's not, restricted to the United States. We're seeing it obviously in places like Hungary and Poland, and in fact, most European countries. So there are enormous changes taking place in the societies that we're talking about, in particular the United States. And it's absolutely true, I think, that the election of Donald Trump and the way he speaks publicly has helped to accelerate this in a very dramatic fashion. You know, when Donald Trump talks about black countries being hellholes, not the word he used, and makes, you know, a whole series of other kinds of racist comments, it essentially gives people permission to feel that they can also make those kinds of comments, that the lid is off Pandora's box, and we are now allowed to engage in this kind of dialogue.
So we know that extremism is on the rise worldwide, but in the United States, what is, would you say, the cause or that precipitates this increase?
Sure. Well, I think that, as I just referenced a little bit ago, I think, you know, the society is going through enormous changes that are ultimately the result of globalization. So I think, you know, there are three major categories of effects that are driving this, or causes that are driving this. One, of course, is what is happening demographically in the United States as a result, largely, of globalization. And that, of course, is the loss of a white majority. This country has been 90% white almost since the very beginning of the colonial era, right up through the 1960s, the early 1960s. And yet here we are at a point where I think we're about 67, 66% white at this point. But within the next 20 years, 25 at the very most, white people will be less than 50% of the population in the United States. So, you know, I'm certainly not suggesting that's a bad thing, in many ways a very good thing, but these are huge changes, and there are very large numbers of people who resent it greatly. Then, of course, there are the economic effects of globalization, and what that means is huge sectors of the economy are you know, in terrible trouble, and they're not, just no matter what Donald Trump says, you know, for instance, the coal industry is not going to recover. The textile industry is not going to recover. Basic steel is not going to be smelted in this country. Those things are simply gone as a result of globalization, and there's really no moving backward from that. So you have large numbers of people who are in trouble in that way, and angry and looking essentially for someone to blame. And the third factor I would point out is the enormous cultural changes that we've seen accompanying all this. And probably the best single example of that is the legalization in all 50 states of same-sex marriage, something which I think would have seemed virtually unimaginable to almost anyone in this country a mere 10 or 15 years ago. You know, you add to this very volatile mix a president like Donald Trump, who is willing to express, in my opinion, in baldly racist terms, the angst and the anger surrounding all of these changes, and you have a kind of conflagration. You know, one thing that may be of interest is to point out, I think, that this is not dissimilar. It's quite similar to what we saw in the United States in the 1920s. That was a period when enormous changes were happening in the society. America was changing from a predominantly rural country to a predominantly urban country. It was industrializing. People were leaving the farms. At the same time, there were changes like women receiving the right to vote for the first time in our history in 1920, like the famous Scopes trial, in which religion and evolution were very much tested in the court. And other really big changes. You know, sex was out in the open in the 1920s in a way it had never been before in American society, the flappers and all of that. So, you know, what happened was, you know, an enormous reaction. And in fact, in the mid-1920s, about 1925, the United States had its largest Ku Klux Klan ever. There were some 4 million members of the Ku Klux Klan. The comparison to today is there are perhaps 4,000 members. So, and the Klan was, and the kind of ethno-nationalist movement back then was very successful, culminating in 1925 in an immigration act which essentially limited immigration to the United States to white Northern Europeans, to Germanic, so-called Aryan peoples. So that ended in the mid-1960s when the immigration law was reformed. But what I'm saying is, you know, they're very similar kinds of changes. Back in the mid-1920s, at its peak, the percentage of foreign-born people in the United States reached about 14.7%. That was in 1910, about 13.2% in 1920. Well, you know, that's much higher than it had ever been or has been since until very recently. We are now at about 14% foreign-born, and, you know, that's just an easy measure to see the kind of discomfort as it grows in the society with people who are, quote-unquote, not like us.
Yes, and as we are on demographics, we're going to expound on it some more, because the president did not invent racism. He has merely exploited it for his political gain. We spoke a little about a while ago, but let's expound a little bit. Does the shifting demographics have anything to do with the rise of racism in the country? In the not-too-distant future, as you said earlier, white people will be a minority group. Hispanics will be in the majority. Your thoughts, expounding that just a little bit more.
Well, I don't think there's any question that that is driving a lot of this. When you look at some of the academic polling that has been done, and quite a lot of serious polling work has been done since Trump was elected, you know, what you find is that immigration best expresses, you know, concerns about immigration is what most reflects the reasons that people voted for Trump. You know, and of course, studies also show that Americans grotesquely overestimate the number of immigrants in this country. I just read a couple of days ago that, you know, over 30, the average that Americans believe is that there's something like 30 or 35% of the population is immigrants. And, you know, that's not nearly true, mm-hmm. But it is an expression, I think, of people feeling, you know, of having this very reactionary response to what is going on around them. And it boils down to the idea of this is not the country I grew up in. This is not the place I grew up in. You know, there are all of these people around me who don't look like me and don't feel like me. And it makes it very easy to lay the blame on someone else's doorstep. I mean, I live in the state of Alabama, and of course, Alabama has a very long history of racial strife.
Mm-hmm.
However, it has always been, Alabama has been essentially a story of two races, white people and black people. Well, you know, that's no longer true. Now there's a very large minority of Latino people, of Hispanics. So, you know, cities are changing, and all of these things are going on, all of these difficulties, and there's, you know, just the classic response of scapegoating someone who is not like you. It must be their fault. It must be the people who moved in down the block from me who are unlike all my other neighbors, who maybe, you know, the woman wears a hijab or whatever it may be.
This president says he's the least racist person you can find. Would you say this president is a racist?
Do I think he's a racist?
Yes.
Absolutely. I would not have said that probably during the election, only because, you know, I think it's sometimes a losing game to decree that someone you see on television is a racist or not. I think even then, during the campaign, you could say, well, whether or not he is a racist inside of his head, certainly the things he says and does are racist. So let's remember that even during the campaign, even before the campaign, of course, Trump was a leading exponent of the idea that Barack Obama could not be an American. When Obama finally presented his long-form birth certificate, Trump's response, again, during the campaign, was to say, well, he certainly could not have gone to Harvard and done as well as he did because unless it was some, you know, secret deal that was cut, unless someone was writing his papers for him and so on. So, you know,
he
now
also wanted to see his transcripts as well.
I'm sorry?
He also wanted to see his transcripts from Harvard.
That's right. That's right. In other words, you know, a black man like Barack Obama couldn't possibly have done it on his own. And, you know, I don't think I need to recite the whole litany of things since then. But, you know, I mean, we all remember Charlottesville and the president's response.
Yes,
you know, to me, an incredible moment was when he talked about what he really wanted was Norwegians, you know,
mm-hmm.
For immigrants in this country.
Yeah. We're going to touch on that, the Charlottesville incident, in a little while. But, We could also expound on that a little in terms of the Central Park Five. That's another thing from way back when.
Sure, of course. I mean, an incredible story, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, the Central Park Five were convicted unfairly, unjustly, of the rape of a jogger in Central Park, and Trump took out a full-page ads in the New York City newspapers calling for the death penalty, that they should be killed. They were, you know, savages and so on, speaking in just baldly racist terms about them. And this was at a time when already serious doubts were arising as to their guilt. Ultimately, it was found absolutely through DNA forensic evidence that they were not the guilty parties at all. They were free. As obviously they should have been, and Trump's response was precisely zero. In other words, there was never, you know, forget an apology from a man like Donald Trump, there was never even a slight withdrawal of the idea that these five young men should have been put, you know, in an electric chair or a gas chamber or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think as we all know, Donald Trump is not interested in the truth of any situation at all. It's simply, he says what he says in order to get his base, which is largely a racist base, although I would not say entirely, riled up. I mean, the man is incredible. I mean, quite apart from racial extremism, the idea that he could, for instance, say, he and Pompeo, that, they'd had this wonderfully productive talk with North Korea about denuclearizing, and then to have the Koreans turn around and say the Americans were gangsters in these talks. I mean, you know, that just exemplifies the relationship with truth that the current administration has.
Yes. This president doesn't have. He doesn't have an affinity for the truth. He lies so much each day that you can't trust what's coming out of his mouth. You can't trust what's coming out of the entire administration because they lie so much. And I know you are not a psychologist, but do you know why racists refuse to be called such?
I'm sorry, do I know why racists...
Why racists refuse to be called racists?
Well, you know, it has become in American society and Western society generally one of the worst things you can say about someone. So, you know, the response, you know, I think it's perfectly obvious that American society has, you know, very, very deep and fundamental continuing problems with race. The response of people, so you know, there are certainly racist people and racist incidents happening every day in this country. We think of people, you know, being thrown out of swimming pools for being black and so on. And the response of people to being called out in that way is fury. You know, there was another interesting study that came out a few weeks ago, which showed that you are far less likely to convince someone to not be a racist or to at least not act in racist ways if you accuse them of being a racist in some way. In other words, people have very defensive responses. If you somehow allow them to come to the idea that maybe I shouldn't attack these people because of their color of the skin, of their skin on their own, they are far more likely to come to that position than if they are called racists. So there's this kind of battle back and forth in the public media and social media, you know, in living rooms all around the country over, you know, what it means to be a racist and so on. You know, in the case of Trump, I just think it has reached the point where it's absolutely undeniable. I mean, there is this just long, long record of Trump's, you know, attitude towards people who are not like him, who are not essentially rich and white.
Another psychology question for you. With all this racist behavior and him being a racist, why do you think so many black people are being his biggest apologists for the lies and the racist things that he does and says?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about the sort of the Kanye Wests of the world, you know, it seems like, first of all, I mean, I don't think so many black people are apologists for Trump. I think that, or for the racism we see all around us. I think it's, you know, relatively small minority. You know, I think for someone like Kanye West, it is simply sidling up to power, right? The guy, you know, represents raw power in the most vulgar forms, right? You know, where your toilet seat is plated in gold and that kind of thing. So, you know, I think for a certain subset of people, Trump represents this kind of fabulous, you know, beautiful women, lots of gold, you know, tons of money, success. So that I think is by and large what explains that. You know, I mean, there are of course contrarians. I mean, I think of you know, the black commentators we see on television who seem to have been sought out because they you know, have views very much at odds with most of the black community. So, you know, there's a certain media interest in people like that, people who seem unexpected in their views.
Speaking with Mark Potok, a senior fellow at the Center for Analysis of the Radical Right. He's live on the telephone. We are discussing racial extremism in the United States since this president came to office and whether it is on the rise. And we touched on it a little earlier, but last year, August, when Heather Heyer, a counter-protester, was killed opposing a Unite the Right rally of racists in Charlottesville, Virginia. The president, with his false moral equivalency, said they were bad people on both sides. With that proclamation,
and
wasn't he given
on both sides too? Huh? He said.
Say it again.
And he said there were good people on both sides as well as bad people. So, yes.
So, would you say that those proclamations gave fodder for and fuel to racists in the country?
Sure. I think absolutely. I mean, remember immediately after he made those statements, David Duke, the infamous former Klan leader, was among those who celebrated. You know, this was a wonderful statement, as Duke said at the time. You know, the radical right, the alternative right, whatever you want to call it, could hardly have gotten a better, a more complete endorsement from someone who was the president of the United States. You know, I think anyone with any sense understands that there was no moral equivalence, right? I mean, we had on the one side people who were essentially Klansmen. And not only that, but violent Klansmen, right? People who were beating up other people, with lead pipes and so on. And then on the other side, the counter-protesting side, of course, we had people who were opposed to racism, who by and large were not violent. People like Heather Heyer, who was murdered for her trouble.
We should also say she was a white woman.
Yeah, she was, of course, a white woman by chance, right? It could have been anybody. This Alex Fields character drove a car into a crowd, clearly intending to kill or hurt as many people as he could. As it happened, Heather Heyer was the unfortunate human being who had to pay with her life.
When the head of the government, the head of the country, is racist, along with some around him, how does one achieve equal rights and justice for all people? If he's a racist, his policies will also be racist. How does one counter that?
Well, not with a great deal of ease. We have been struggling with that for many, many decades, if not our entire history. If I had an easy answer, perhaps I too would be a wealthy man. No, just kidding. But I think that ultimately we are going to see this kind of battle over the changing nature of our country continue for the next 20 or 30 years. My hope is that it will not get a whole lot worse than it is now, and it's very bad right now, and that piece by piece we will near the end of this tunnel, and as the country's demographic transformation is more or less completed, perhaps we will emerge at the end of this tunnel in a better place. Ultimately, where the United States is heading is to becoming a country in which no one group of people is the majority, in which every group of people, are a minority. In other words, with some luck, we will be a society in which no one group of people rules the other. And, I think there's some reasons for hope, quite apart from the immediate things that are happening today. I think in particular of the attitudes of young people in this country. And, one of the more interesting things is that virtually no young people, something like 95% of people, of young people, 14 to 24, according to the polling, have no problem at all with interracial relationships or marriages and so on. And similarly, the vast majority of young people have no problem with same-sex relationships. So that gives, some sense of how our society will change as one generation dies off and another starts to take over. But, it's a very difficult moment. Trump is, an incredibly kind of evil influence on what is happening. He is certainly making things much worse than they might have been. And that's the danger. So, that's not, I don't have any great solution for what we all need to do this week or next week. But one hopes and I believe that the forces of history will bring us to a different place in the end.
Indeed. And we'll get back to the present in a little bit. Have white supremacists increased their presence on the Internet within the last 17 months or so?
Well, I'm not sure they've increased their presence. What you see a lot more of is not white supremacists, sort of professional, organized white racist activists, but what I think we see a lot more of on the Internet and on the street is a garden variety everyday racism. That is certainly growing, and I think this spate of cases we have seen, you know, a black kid being thrown out of a swimming pool, all those kinds of cases, a little boy being, you know, having the police called on him for selling water in the street, you know, six-year-old child, all of these kinds of things, I think, really reflect, you know, those aren't the activities of organized Klansmen. Those are, quote-unquote, normal, everyday people. So, you know, on the other hand, it is true that real white supremacists, racist activists, are extremely active on the Internet, and you see that particularly within the section of the radical right that is known as the alternative right. And, you know, what I'm meaning when I say alternative right is essentially a kind of younger, hipper, more educated set of white supremacists.
Calling themselves the alt-right.
The answers of the world.
The alt-right, which means alternative right.
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear
that. So alt-right, which means alternative right.
That's right. And, you know, in many ways, the alternative right is simply a rebranding for public relations purposes of the old white supremacist right. But there are some kind of unique aspects of it. I mean, I think the alternative right is much more, as I say, associated with people like Richard Spencer, a kind of infamous activist, white supremacist who was in Charlottesville, but who is a guy who, you know, got a history degree from the University of Chicago, one of the best schools in the country, you know, who dresses in chinos and polo shirts and topsiders, right? In other words, is this very kind of yuppie, right? He doesn't look like, you know, the skinheads we think of from the 1980s or 1990s. He doesn't have swastika tattoos on his chest. You know, on the contrary, he looks like somebody, you know, who's about to get a job at Goldman Sachs. So there's been a kind of gussying up of a sector of the radical right in order to make it more attractive to young people, and I think, in fact, it has attracted quite a lot more young people.
So who are they targeting, the white supremacists online? Who are they targeting these days?
Well, I don't know if they're precisely targeting people, but I think they are more and more attractive and very much want to be to people who are educated or at least relatively educated. So especially within the so-called alternative right, you have a real effort to kind of get away, as I say, from the tattoos of swastikas and so on, you know, from the thuggish, well-deserved thuggish reputation of the white supremacist right, and to present itself, you know, as some kind of real ideology, something with a real intellectual tradition and so on. So, you know, we see more and more of these quote-unquote scholars who are attempting to provide a kind of theoretical basis for racism and for anti-Semitism. You know, I mean, there has been some incredible writing by quote-unquote scholars, you know, seeking to justify anti-Semitism, the idea, you know, essentially Nazi views, right, that the Jews are up to no good. They're, you know, they're trying to undermine our society and you know, destroy it for their own wicked purposes and so on.
With all the noise in Washington, D.C., questionable shooting deaths of black men by the police continue. Are you able to say whether the number of killings of black people by the police has increased over the past 17 months?
No, I can't say that simply because I don't have the data in front of me. I'm not sure that's true. But, you know, I think what's probably more what has happened is that there is more and more, you know, people are, the society is more and more conscious of these killings. So they're getting more attention. And, you know, just as a practical matter, the fact that virtually everyone out there has cell phones on them, in other words, has a video camera in their pocket, has kind of surfaced this sort of violence in a new way. you know, I mean, it's worth thinking about. For instance, in South Carolina, the police officer about 3 years ago shot a man running away from him, presenting zero danger to him. You know, I think it's very unlikely that that person would have been charged and convicted of murder. And yet that's what happened, because there was a cell phone video, you know, which was simply undeniable, right? I mean, no one could argue with what the video showed.
Okay, speaking with Mark Potok, a senior fellow at the Center for Analysis of the Radical Right. He's live on the telephone. We are discussing racial extremism in the United States since this president came to office and whether it is on the rise. And my name is Garnet Ankle. The show is What's Your Point? And we touched on this earlier, but there have been incidents of white university students calling police on black people for no logical reason. And you mentioned earlier on about issues and people calling police on people, that kind of thing. Any data to share on white students behaving in racist ways towards other students in schools generally? Any data to say whether this is on the increase or not?
Well, you know, as an anecdotal matter, yes, it seems to be on the increase. I'm not sure how gigantic the movement is on American campuses. Obviously, Richard Spencer and many of the other kind of leaders of the alternative right have made a very big effort to reach college campuses. And, you know, this is a part of what we were speaking about earlier, the idea that the radical right, the white supremacist right, is becoming more educated. That said, I still think it's a very small percentage of students on campuses who are of this view. You know, when you see, for instance, efforts to get Richard Spencer to speak at various universities, it is typically one or five or maybe 10 people who are trying to bring him in to speak, and thousands of students who are opposing him. So, you know, yes, there's more activity on campus. Yes, there are more better educated young white supremacists. But no, I don't think that they are taking over the universities at all. And in some ways, their presence, their kind of enlarged presence at universities, has caused an even larger reaction.
Maybe they were there on the surface, but they're just bubbling up now to the fore since this president came to office.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, one thing I think that certainly 10, 15 years ago, people thought of university campuses as being, you know, sort of gardens of enlightenment. And these were where people civilly debated, you know, and thought deep thoughts about the world and learning and so on. While there's some truth to that, of course, the truth, you know, perhaps the deeper truth is that university campuses reflect the society around them. And we've seen for many years how white kids, particularly leaving home for the first time, leaving very homogenous environments, racially and economically homogenous environments. In other words, white kids from the well-to-do suburbs, where, you know, they don't live around anybody who isn't white or who isn't relatively well-to-do. You know, these kids arrive on campus sometimes and are shocked. Right? I mean, they have never been so close to Muslims, to black people, to brown people, to people who are not like them, people who are perhaps openly LGBTQ or whatever it may be. So, you know, it's been a bit of a myth, I think, for decades that university campuses are somehow better than the rest of society. And, you know, I mean, not to go too far back in time, but one need only think of the reaction of students at places like the University of Alabama to the desegregation of schools in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Amnesty International says the United States president is engaged in a politics of hate due to his Muslim travel ban. The third version of the ban was recently upheld by the United States Supreme Court in a 5-4 ruling. The travel ban was originally for 7 Muslim-majority nations: Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, Iran, Iraq, Libya, and Egypt. The third travel ban include Venezuela, North Korea, Iran, Syria, Libya, Yemen, and Somalia. This was to be a temporary ban. According to my count, it would have already been expired. Who's counting anyway? But five of the seven nations are Muslim majority ones. Is this travel ban racist?
Sure. It's racist or it's religious bigotry or racial bigotry, whichever you want to call it. But, obviously the travel ban was simply retooled in a superficial way in order to get it past the Supreme Court. I think that's really all that happened. And now, of course, we're facing the very, very real and immediate danger of seeing another right-wing justice named to the court by President Trump. So that, mm-hmm. These kinds of things will increasingly pass muster with the Supreme Court. So, that is a bit of a terrifying thing to see that, the rule of law is in some real danger as well.
Yes, indeed. We should also note the travel ban does not include Egypt, Saudi Arabia, where the 9/11 hijackers came from, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates, countries where the president has businesses. I want to remind the listening audience of Article 14, Section 1 of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which the United States is a signatory. It says, quote, "Everyone has the right to seek and to enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution," end quote. The United Nations said the president of the United States separating of migrant children with parents, quote, "may amount to torture," end quote, in a damning condemnation. The president has since rescinded this separation, and the damage may have already been done. These are people seeking asylum from their respective nations in Central America. They're running away from violence. Mark, what's your thoughts on this debacle?
Well, my reaction is, my God, haven't we been here before? Isn't this the lesson that we were all supposed to have learned from the horrors of World War II, right? I mean, that's where the Declaration of Human Rights came out of, the experience in World War II, when country after country after country in Europe and the North American continent refused to accept refugees. At the time, of course, the alternative was annihilation, right? So, I don't think I'm telling our listeners anything they haven't heard before when I say that, an extremely small number of Jewish refugees and other refugees were admitted to this country during the war. And as a fairly direct result, many hundreds of thousands of people were murdered who needn't have been. So, it's a sad thing. My own father was a survivor of the Holocaust. He grew up in Poland and fled in 1939 and, just barely escaped. It is really, as I say, a sad thing to see that we are back in the same place. And my God, Donald Trump's role in this has been a horrific one. The idea that, immigrants are coming to infest our country, as he says, as
yes.
if he's speaking of cockroaches.
Indeed.
That it's MS-13, that these, young people coming to our borders are savages, murderers, rapists, and so on. And, this is how Donald Trump started his campaign with this speech in 2015 in which he demonized Mexican immigrants as rapists and drug dealers.
Indeed. No talk about...
That rhetoric has only gotten worse.
Indeed. And no talk about those coming from Europe.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just seems to get worse every day. And, obviously the separation of children at the border is just an unbelievable thing to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And, as we look at the reports of what's happening on the border, it becomes more and more obvious that some of those children will never find their parents again. Can you imagine?
Mm-hmm.
These are people who are being arrested for misdemeanors.
Mm-hmm.
It's like running a red light, and having the authorities show up at your house and drag your kids away, never to be seen again. It is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. And just continuing on that, the government claimed they knew where the separated children were housed. Now the court has ordered the government to reunite children with parents. The court gave the government until Tuesday to reunite children under five with their parents. The government is asking for more time. Now the government wants to use DNA to match parents with children. Is this a sinister action by the government? Is this legal?
I mean, you know, I'm not a lawyer and can't say if it's legal. It seems unbelievable. And, you know, the most remarkable thing with the government asking for more time and more time from the courts to do this reuniting is that, in fact, when they say they know where all the children are, they are lying. That is a falsehood. It's perfectly obvious that the government does not know where most of these children are, that the government, the administration, had absolutely no plan for tracking these children or somehow keeping them at least tenuously linked to their parents. You know, and so I think the very real danger now, and really the probability, is that at least some of those parents will never see their children again. I mean, as to the legal question, it's hard to believe that if that went through the court system, that it would not be found unconstitutional, right? I mean, really? You can take my children away from me because I have been accused of, not even convicted of, a misdemeanor? It seems unfathomable that that is constitutional. But again, I'm not a constitutional lawyer.
But these are people coming across, entering a foreign country, seeking asylum at the border. The thing about it, too, is that the Attorney General did say when they come, they're going to prosecute them and they're going to be taking them away. He said it in May. They're going to be separating the children from their parents. This was something that was said. So,
yeah, I know. I mean, look, Jeff Sessions comes from Alabama, mm-hmm. my state.
Yes.
You know, and the man, yes, absolutely made these comments that this was the intention, that the children, in effect, were going to be used as kidnapped hostages in order to lower the level of people seeking asylum. And, you know, as you've pointed out, under United Nations conventions, people have the absolute right to request asylum without being punished for it. And that is true for all of these countries. So, you know, if the United States simply refuses to even listen to people's application and in the course of that steal the children away from their parents, it seems obvious that it is a complete violation of the United Nations conventions of international law.
Even after rescinding the separation, the president said all immigrants crossing the border should be turned back and not given due process rights. How is he getting away with this unconstitutional pronouncement? Which Border Patrol person is going to obey that illegal order? This is illegal. This is unconstitutional.
Right, right. I mean, it's not. Look, I mean, the president proposes things that are illegal all the time. You know, not so long ago, last month or so, he was proposing that he reform the immigration system through an executive order. You know, I mean, the man seems to be a moron. You know, that the legislation is needed to come to some kind of solution to the immigration problem. But, you know, he thinks he can do it by writing something on a piece of paper and signing it himself. So, you know, I mean, it hardly seems different from many other things the president has said, which are plainly illegal. I mean, you know, it's remarkable that the Muslim ban in its third form, as you mentioned earlier, has gotten through because, you know, what a very large number of lower federal courts found was that it was obvious from Trump's speeches and what he said on the campaign trail and afterwards that the ban really was religiously motivated, right? We don't like Muslims in this country. They are banned. And, of course, they played with the language of the ban to try and get it through the courts. But I think anyone with, you know, a grain of sense can see what the real intent was, and that was to keep Muslims out of the United States because they are not like us, as the president seems to think.
What does the future hold for justice and fair play under this White House, you think?
What are the prospects for justice under this White House? Is that what you're asking me?
Yes.
Well, not very high, that's for sure. You know, I think, look, you know, I think in some ways, as I said earlier, and making a comparison to the present time to the 1920s, in some ways we're at a very dangerous moment. You know, the 1920s, of course, led to the 1930s and the rise of fascism and mass genocide around Europe and the world. You know, the one thing I would say is that I think we are in a somewhat different position now, in that, at least in the United States, civil society is far more built out, far more resilient than was so in the 1920s. Of course, you know, that is not true in all countries. You know, think of a country like Poland or Hungary, where we are seeing the very same kinds of hatred directed at immigrants, at people applying for refugee status, and so on, and also, you know, a very kind of racial, ethnic nationalism. You know, those countries, obviously, I think, you know, civil society is far, far weaker, and the danger, really, of losing democracy entirely is, I think, more real. You know, just look at what is going on in Poland in the battle between, you know, to Viktor Orban, or rather the Poles' attempt to get rid of, you know, the large number of judges in order to twist the system. So, you know, democracy is under assault, in more liberal democracy is under assault very much in a very large number of countries. But again, I have a little more hope for the United States, despite the Trump administration, simply because, you know, we do have a robust court system. We do have, you know, at least people, at least journalists are not being, you know, spirited away and murdered by secret police at this point. So, you know, my hope is that the country can survive a Trump administration, but we will see. It's been very, very bad, and the naming of a Supreme Court justice, another Supreme Court justice by Donald Trump, is frankly terrifying.
Indeed. And but he's trying his best to undermine the media because they're accurately reporting on him. He's calling them fake news because he doesn't like the accurate reporting that he's getting. So we've got to...
I mean, look, let me say, you know, to me, his attitude towards the media, of course, you know, I've been a part of the media for, you know, most of my 30-some years, is enraging. And, you know, I know it's bad form to lay at Trump's feet the murder of five journalists in Annapolis a week or two ago. And it's true that the killer does not seem to have been motivated by a hatred of journalists. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when Trump's reaction to that, his initial reaction to that, is to refuse to even lower the flag, I mean, you know, again, you know, we can't blame directly Donald Trump for the murder of those five people.
And in fact, he did lower the flag afterwards.
The very day before, he talked about, you know, the media as the enemy of the people and so on.
Indeed.
So you know, it's quite something to see.
Yes, you're correct. He did lower the flag later, but after, you know, reluctantly, I think. And
he was embarrassed in the press, right? It didn't look good for him.
Yes.
He seemed like he was pretty much perfectly fine with the murder of those five journalists. So undoubtedly, you know, some people around him, you know, Ivanka or whoever it might have been, you know, said, "Daddy, this doesn't look so good." And, you know, in the same way that for Trump, he didn't like the pictures of the children in prison cages at the border. It's not that he had any sympathy for the children or for their parents. It was simply bad press. It didn't look too good.
Indeed.
So, you know, that's, I think, obviously what happened with the matter of lowering the flag.
He doesn't care about the rule of law, and that is very dangerous. And we have a Congress controlled by Republicans who care not about what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean, and to me, the worry is that, you know, I never thought it would be possible. Of course, I didn't think it was possible that Trump would be elected in the first place, but it's seeming more and more possible that Trump will be reelected. Truly a horror show. And, you know, when you look at the levels of support for Trump among Republicans, I think 88%, 90% are the latest numbers, it's quite incredible. But, you know, I suppose that a part of that is this kind of bifurcation of the media and people's opinions. In other words, you know, if you listen only to Fox, you have a wildly different view of the world and a much less true one than if you watch virtually any other news or read virtually any other news.
That's a propaganda arm of the White House. There's no doubt about it. That's not a news organization.
Yeah, that's right. And sad to say, they are not alone, right? I mean, increasingly, I would say over the last 20 years, we've seen the development of this kind of media that deals with what Kellyanne Conway so famously described as alternative facts.
And there's no such thing.
And, you know, it has gotten worse and worse and worse. And Fox, apparently, a number of the others, are incapable of shame. I used to go on the Sean Hannity show back when it was Hannity and Combs. I used to go on shows with Tucker Carlson. You know, these people are more and more like Klansmen today. You know, they have moved dramatic. I mean, they were very unpleasant people to begin with, but they are reaching the point where they are racial nationalists themselves.
We're closing the show in a short time. Any closing thoughts before we say so long?
Well, again, I just, you know, I may be being Pollyannish, but I do very much hope and somewhat believe that we are ultimately heading for a better place. That is very hard to see, you know, in the fog and the horror of what we're seeing around us right now. But to me, probably the most disheartening recent thing, other than, you know, the advance of climate change and all that that will drive in terms of new immigration flows and new economic disasters, is the idea of the Supreme Court swinging in this dramatic way, because that really has the potential to damage institutions in this country in a way that we have not seen, even under Trump.
Indeed, and we didn't get a time to speak more about the Supreme Court nominee. And thanks again, Mark, for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks again. Bye for now. Okay, that was a live conversation with Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Center for Analysis at the of the Radical Right. We discussed radical extremism in the United States since this president came to office and whether it is on the rise. This is What's Your Point with Garnet Anker. Our next show is 2 weeks from today. You may go in the podcast to listen this in a little while, in about a day's time. You can listen in the podcast. It's available in the archives for the next 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks' time, I'll be back first with Solidarity at 7 a.m. Eastern. So you do take care. Thanks for listening.
Support for WPKN comes from the Great South Bay Music Festival, presenting Allman Brothers founding member Dickie Betts and his band, plus Electric Hot Tuna, the Devin Allman Project, Little Feet, Sublime with Rome, The Dirty Heads, Humphreys McGee, Papa Dozio, and over 65 performers on three stages, plus an arts and crafts market, beer and wine garden, and kids zone, July 12th through the 15th, Shorefront Park in Patchogue on Long Island. More information and tickets at Great South Bay Music Festival.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Gallagher, host of Digging in the Dirt. Join me this coming Monday, July 9th at 5 p.m. when my guest will be Mary DeMocker, author of a new book entitled The Parent's Guide to Climate Revolution, 100 Ways to Build a Fossil-Free Future, Raise Empowered Kids, and Still Get a Good Night's Sleep. That's Digging in the Dirt with Mary DeMocker this coming Monday at 5 p.m. here on listener-supported WPKN.
Sunset. sunflower mazes to tubing in Connecticut rivers, learn how to have fun in the sun, and learn some tips for greening your vacations. Tune in Saturday, July 14th at 9 a.m. for Living the Green Life.
Hear from Randy Fiveash, Director of the Connecticut Office of Tourism, to learn what you can do in Connecticut over the summer and year-round. And for future shows, listen every second Saturday at 9 a.m. for Living the Green Life.
This is FC Buzz on WPKN Radio. A brief look at what's happening around Fairfield County.
This is David Green with the Cultural Alliance of Fairfield County's weekly selection from fcbuzz.org, the best guide to arts and culture in Fairfield County. Through Sunday, Sacred Heart University's Theatre Arts Program presents Barnum, the musical